Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today. And this is another great opportunity to get empowered with truthful information so you can really make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And as always, I have a really great show in store for you that will certainly open your eyes to what's going on regarding our food. Before we get there, however, I just want to remind everyone I'm actually taking a group of people to Costa Rica to a very special place called the Rythmia Center. It's the Rythmia Life Advancement Center. So this is a 7-day program that is not only designed to give you a holiday, but it's actually designed to help you expand your consciousness as well as heal your body. This center is really unique, and it has an experience of massages and colonics and live blood cell analysis and yoga and meditation and aura assessments and daily classes about personal empowerment. And it also includes experiences with the shamans from South America working with the healing power of plant medicines that helps to not only open our consciousness but heal the emotional wounds that have been getting in our way and making our life the successful experience we all yearn to be. So this is happening February 13th to 20th. You go to What Women Must Know, which is my website. There's a link there on the homepage that takes you to the page that gives you a lot more information of everything that's included. So it's a transformational, healing, expansive journey that will be filled with amazing experiences in a beautiful place, one of the blue zones in the world, actually, which are those zones where people have extended lifespans, healthy extended lifespans. An amazing place, an amazing experience. So if you're interested, get in touch with me, check out What Women Must Know, go to the link to the program, and maybe it's the one for you. I'd love to have you join me. So having said that, I want to talk about our topic at hand. Many of us don't really understand what we're getting when we buy certain foods that we love to eat and we think are really healthy, and you are about to get a real education today because my guest is Larry Olmsted, and he is the author of Real Food, Fake Food, a best-selling book, actually, and it's talking about why you don't know what you are eating and what you can do about it. So just let me tell you a little bit about Larry. He is an award-winning journalist and author who has written several thousand articles for major newspapers and magazines worldwide over the past 20-plus years. He has been a print columnist for two of America's three national newspapers, Investors Business Daily and USA Today, and has written for many other prominent papers, including the Financial Times, New York Daily News, Boston Globe, Denver Post, South China Post, and others. His magazine work has included Playboy, Popular Science, Outside, Men's Health, Inc., Worth, American Airlines, American Way, Rob Report, Gulf Magazine, and U.S. Airways Magazine, and dozens of others. He was named one of the 10 most extreme U.S. journalists by the Society of Professional Journalists and Travel Writer of the Year in 2010-11 by the state of Mississippi. His Forbes.com column was named one of the world's top 100 travel sites. He has been a panelist or guest speaker at several conferences and appeared as an expert on radio and television dozens of times. Larry has spent the past 4 years researching the topics of real and fake food, a journey that took him to Japan, Alaska, Chile, Argentina, Scotland, Ireland, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, South Africa, and all across the United States and Canada. What a great job. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Larry Olmsted to the show today. So welcome, Larry.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You do have a good job, you know.
I do. It's a little stressful sometimes, but yeah, it's fun.
Well, I'm one that loves travel, so to be able to combine travel and business is a great opportunity in this lifetime. So good for you. So you write on travel, but here you are writing a book about food. How did that happen?
Well, I've always written a lot on food topics in conjunction with travel. I think. People travel for a lot of different reasons. Some people, travel to go lay at the beach, and some people travel to go to museums, and some people travel to be active. People travel for business, all different reasons why we travel. But everybody who travels eats, typically three times a day. So, and I think people really relish when they travel, eating, foods that are new or different or better in the places they go. And that's certainly my approach. I've always made it a point to eat regional, food. If I go to Japan, I'm going to eat Japanese food the entire time I'm there. I'm not going to go to an Italian restaurant, even if it's really good. And that's sort of what led to this book. I mean, I've eaten food all around the world, good and bad, and I've had a couple of experiences where I had something, really interesting, different, memorable, delicious in a place, and then came back and tried to get it here, and often was disappointed. Probably the prime example would be when I went to Japan and I had the very famous Kobe beef, which is sort of the Rolls Royce of red meat, the most famous, rare, expensive steak in the world, and then tried to get it here, and it was never tasted right or looked right, and I looked into it and found out that the reason it didn't taste or look right is because it wasn't really Kobe beef. It was completely fake in this country, every place that you could get it. And I wrote an article about that for Forbes, how Kobe beef was a big scam here, and the response was really overwhelming. I mean, I've written thousands of articles. I've never gotten feedback like this, where people really were upset about how ripped off they had been. And so I just started to look into other food topics and saw that this is a much, much bigger problem than just Kobe beef.
So were you shocked as you did your research about how fake our food is?
I was. I mean, I was shocked at a number of things, sort of how widespread, how big this problem is, especially in certain sectors of food, but also how audacious some of the scams and misleading things are. And there's a lot of different kinds of fake food. For the purposes of my book, I define fake food as when you don't get what you think you're buying or what you think you're ordering if you're in a restaurant, which is kind of broad. But in some cases, it's an illegal substitution. In some cases, the food is adulterated. And in some cases, it's completely legal, but it's a completely, misleading, I would still call it fraud, but, tricking consumers, but doing it legally. So there's a really big gamut of fake foods, but the area of adulterated and counterfeit foods is a $50 billion a year industry worldwide. So this is not, a niche thing.
Well, I'm not particularly naive about how much of our food is adulterated and how much we're lied to. But I have to say, Larry, when I read your book, I was absolutely shocked and horrified to the degree we are so deceived, and the not only the quality, but what added ingredients are put into things that we are eating, thinking it's food when it's not real food at all. It's not nourishing to the body. It's amazing how much of what we eat is compromised in so many ways.
That's true, and I think one thing, when people see the title Real Food, Fake Food, because real food doesn't really have a definition, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder, I think a lot of people expect this to be another book like Fast Food Nation or Food Inc. attacking, processed foods or fast foods, and it's not. Matter of fact, those foods are to a large part left out of my book, and not that they're not a problem, not that they're not often bad for you, but my sort of gist is, when you go to the drive-thru and you get a 99-cent hamburger that doesn't even say it's a beef hamburger or 100% beef or, any claim to what's in it, you're not getting ripped off. You're getting exactly what you would expect when you get a 99-cent hamburger at a fast food restaurant. It might be low quality, but you can't really expect to get high quality for that, you know, in that setting for that amount of money. So, you know, while that's like a very, very big problem, and those foods have a lot of additives, most of mine is things that you would not expect, you know, where you're buying something you think is actually wholesome, or you're going out of your way to eat healthier, and you're still getting defrauded.
Well, we're going to go through a lot of these foods that you have talked about in the book, and I want to start with the fish story. Let's really help people understand what's going on in the world of fish.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, since my book came out, I actually spoke to someone in the fish industry about some of the changes that are going on now, and he said, you know, you got to remember, fishermen have always been famous for telling stories. You know, and I didn't really think of it in that way. You know, it's kind of the famous joke of, you know, your fish that you caught gets bigger and bigger the more times you tell the story. And, you know, that's sort of a humorous take, you know, on the fictional or exaggerated fish story. But the unfortunate reality is that there's a lot of fish stories being told in the real marketplace. And it's really rife with problems, but it's not because the people in the fish industry are not evil compared to people in the beef or chicken industry. You know, the reason is because there's so many kinds of fish. You know, we all know what chicken looks like or what a steak looks like, and if you go to a restaurant and you order a T-bone steak and they serve you a chicken leg, you're going to know right away that something is up. But most Americans don't really know what fish looks like, and most of the fish we buy is already processed, meaning, you know, it's cut into fillets, and pretty much any white fish, which is most kinds of fish that consumers buy, looks the same once it's filleted. So I just had a fish distributor tell me I could take, you know, any three white fish, whether it's, you know, red snapper or grouper or tilapia, and put them next to each other on the counter, and you can't tell them apart. So that makes it really easy to fool consumers. And there's also a huge financial temptation because sometimes one fish costs 10 times as much as another fish that looks exactly the same. So you can make a lot of money if you take a high-value fish like red snapper or grouper or cod and substitute a cheaper fish. And it's no coincidence that those are the most substituted fish. It's directly related to the cost of the fish. The sort of the more valuable it is, the more likely you are to be ripped off.
So when it comes to the whitefish, is there any way the consumer could know what they're getting?
Well, at retail, so the largest national study by a nonprofit group called Oceana showed that about a third of all seafood across the country at retail and restaurants is mislabeled, and that's usually intentionally. That's mislabeled to deceive, meaning you're not getting the species you think you're buying, or in the case of certain species like salmon, you might be buying wild-caught but getting farmed. So some sort of manipulation of the terms. But with some of these whitefish like grouper and snapper, it's actually much higher than a third. In some cases, it's over 90% of the time you don't get the real thing. It's a lot harder in restaurants to tell. You have to rely more on the reputation of the restaurant and you know, ask questions and sort of the feel you get from the place. But at retail, there are definitely things you can do. I recommend in the book, I give at the end of each chapter for each type of food or each category of food, I give some very specific buying tips. But one of the things I recommend with seafood is there's a few third-party certifying bodies, which are typically nonprofits, which fish distributors will pay to basically verify the authenticity of their product and put a label, sort of like the Good Housekeeping seal, on their products at retail. And the best one of those for wild-caught fish is called the Marine Stewardship Council. And it has a seal that is a blue fish in the shape of a check mark that says MSC. And I talked to a number of experts, and they all said that's the best one, and I put that in the book as a tip. But since the book's come out, I found out that there was just a big international study done of the MSC labeling in 16 countries across hundreds of different kinds of fish products, and their label proved to be 99.4% accurate in an industry where the norm is more like 60%. So it is a really good thing to look for. You can find that typically on bags of like frozen fish fillets, things like that, you know, at the supermarket. And then I have a number of other tips like that, what to look for in the labeling.
Are you more likely to get true fish in places like Whole Foods as opposed to a supermarket chain?
Yeah, and I don't like to generalize about the supermarket chains because it's an odd thing in our country that we don't really have a truly national supermarket chain. You know, we have things like Walmart that are everywhere, but when it comes to supermarkets, it's still pretty regional. You know, if you live in the South, you might shop at Kroger, and if you live in, you know, New England, you shop at Hannaford, and, you know, there's a lot of chains, but none of them are truly national, so I don't like to, you know, sort of say one is better than the other. But Whole Foods does do a really good job with its seafood traceability, and I actually went to the flagship Whole Foods in Austin and met with their seafood buyers and sort of went over their programs. And while Whole Foods definitely sells some things that I would not buy, they're at least labeled correctly. So they might have farm salmon next to Alaskan wild-caught salmon, and I don't want the farm salmon, but I believe at Whole Foods that when I buy the wild salmon, I'm getting it. Same for shrimp. They'll have, you know, wild-caught shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico, which I will eat, next to farm shrimp from Vietnam, which I will not eat. But in each case, it's really clearly labeled, and they put a lot of resources into authenticating that, whereas Consumer Reports did a study of supermarkets across the country where they bought wild-caught salmon, and more than 50% of the time it was not wild-caught salmon. It was farmed. And people, you know, consumers have shown a preference for wild-caught and are willing to pay more for it, and that becomes a problem when you pay more and you want it and you're not getting it.
And not only that, but the whole nutritional content of real Alaskan salmon compared to farm salmon is so different. You're not really getting a healthy fish, nutritionally speaking. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that for my listeners who don't really understand the difference between the real Alaskan salmon and then the farm salmon, and what goes into a farm salmon, and why you want to avoid any salmon that isn't the real deal. I think, you know, you do a good job in explaining. So why don't you help my listeners understand the distinction?
Sure. And I should preface this by saying, you know, that I am not a doctor. So, you know, most of that, the sort of the health ramifications of the advice I gave in my book is from studies and other sources. But an aquaculture, which is, you know, fish farming, is not inherently bad. About 40% of the seafood that we eat in this country today is farmed, but it's still a very young industry compared to, you know, the other forms of farming we have, like cattle and pigs and tomatoes, you know, all of which have been around for centuries and centuries. So aquaculture is really about 40 years old, and it's evolving and improving fast, but you have to look at it as still in its rudimentary stages. So salmon in the wild, salmon are carnivores. They eat other fish. And they also eat microscopic organisms called krill, and that is what turns salmon pink. Salmon are not natural. They're not born pink. They're pink because of their diet. So in farms, they're typically fed pelletized food, a lot of which is made out of vegetables and corn, which is not grain, something that they eat ever in the wild. That's one thing. And then there's the color. So originally they actually had to add dye to the salmon's food to make them pink. And the process of enriching their feed to make them pink has gotten better. But it's still, you know, somewhat of an artificial process. And there are better salmon farms. There's one in Maine called True North that just became the first domestic salmon farm ever to get the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seal of Approval, which is sort of the gold standard for how fish are caught or produced or sustainable or healthy. So, you know, if you, I guess it's like being an organic vegetable farmer. If you take the time and raise a more expensive, more carefully done product, you can farm fish well, but it's not the norm. Fish farming, like cattle farming, like pig farming, there's a lot of antibiotics used in aquaculture. There's a lot of other chemicals. So One problem is that you can get drugs that you don't want in your fish, just like you get drugs you don't want in your beef and your chicken and your pork in this country. And the second is the actual the health aspects in terms of the ratio of the omega 3 and 6. And when, you know, a lot of people believe that when you deviate from the salmon's natural diet, you reduce the level of the good or the goodness of that ratio. And it's very similar to cattle. I believe that grass-fed, truly grass-fed beef, meaning eating nothing but grass, which is the way cattle have always been until the last century or so, is much better for you in terms of the fat than our industrial cattle. And we kind of live in a time where, you know, there's this a lot of blowback against red meat. You know, people tell you, oh, don't eat so much red meat, it's not good for your heart. But the truth is, the countries that eat the most red meat, like Argentina and Uruguay, which eat a lot more than we do, have much better cardiovascular health. And it's not that the beef itself is bad for you, it's that the beef, the way that we raise it in this country, is bad for you. So I personally now eat only truly grass-fed beef, and I think it's the same argument to be made with the salmon, the wild salmon. You know, It eats the diet it's supposed to eat.
You know, I was really surprised to learn from you that even if it says wild caught, it can still be a farmed salmon.
Well, not legally, but it's a widespread fraud. Like I said, when Consumer Reports tested supermarket samples, more than 50% of the time in restaurants, it's probably even worse than that because, first of all, you know, restaurants are not subject to the same labeling laws from the FDA and the USDA that retail are, but also there's much less accountability. If a large retailer, like a supermarket chain, gets caught defrauding consumers, they're a very easy target for a lawsuit. And the way a lot of these food crimes work is there are often no criminal sanctions. They're resolved through civil suits. So, you know, you get a lawyer to take on a class action suit. And the reality is that's all based on how much money the lawyer stands to make versus the damages. So if you have an individual restaurant and say it's serving you, you know, it claims it's serving you wild-caught Alaskan salmon and charging you $30 for that entree, but they're really not. They're selling you farm salmon, and that entree should cost $15. Then your damage as a consumer is the difference, or $15. So if they do that, you know, 1,000 times, they've just made $15,000. But no lawyer is going to sue a restaurant for $15,000. It's just not worth it. So the class action suits typically do not work against individual restaurants, which is why they seem to feel free to just lie on the menu, which happens all the time.
Is there any way when you go to a restaurant you want to order what looks like wild caught? Are there questions to ask? Is there any way to know, or are you just at their mercy?
Well, I mean, I look at it, you know, typically if you're going to eat seafood at a restaurant, you're best off eating at a restaurant that specializes in seafood. And whether it's wild-caught salmon or red snapper or Dover sole, if these are, you know, high-value, less common fish, they're not that easy to get. They don't, you know, most fish that's delivered to restaurants in America is processed, frozen, and comes in boxes. It's, you know, tilapia fillets that they're going to use in fish and chips, or, you know, that's how the fish comes in. Whereas, you know, really good seafood restaurants are actually getting fish, and they're cutting them up. So typically, for them to get good quality fish, they have to deal through a specialized distributor rather than just ordering boxes of frozen fillets from their general food distributor. So I always ask, and I always recommend asking, you know, who is your seafood distributor? And you might not know the names of these places, but if the waiter can say, you know, oh, yeah, we get it from, you know, ABC Fish in Sarasota, Florida, that's a good answer. If they say, I don't know, that's not a good answer, because they really can't be getting this good quality fish if they don't know who they're getting it from. And sometimes the restaurant isn't even to blame. Sometimes the restaurant is being duped by their supplier. They think they're buying wild-caught Alaskan salmon, and they're not. But it's important, I think, for them to know who they're getting it from and have some you know, sort of idea of the specifics. If the waiter and the chef and the restaurant seem ignorant about the seafood, it's probably not very good.
Well, that's a good tip. And one more thing before we leave the seafood department. You had some really harsh things to say about sushi and what we really are getting when we order sushi, which is so popular now. So enlighten us more about the sushi scene.
Sure, and I should preface this by saying I love sushi, right? I'm not on a mission to bash sushi. You know, writing this book has kind of ruined sushi for me. I don't really eat it anymore, and in fact, I'm going to Japan this winter, and I'm already sort of salivating and looking forward to going and eating sushi again.
Real sushi.
Real sushi. And, you know, there are plenty of restaurants in the United States where you can get good quality sushi, but they tend to be expensive and specialized. And if you're in, you know, New York and you go to Nobu or Masa, or, you know, you're in pretty much any big city, there's going to be a fancy sushi restaurant. And a lot of these places, you know, fly their fish in. Las Vegas is a great example. There's a number of great sushi places in Vegas where, you know, they fly the fish in from Hawaii, from Florida, from even from Japan. You know, sometimes daily, sometimes a couple of times a week, and, you know, that drives the food cost way up. But sushi was never meant, in my opinion, to be an everyday food. You know, if you go to Japan and you go to a good sushi restaurant, you sit at a counter where there's a master chef. I don't know if you've ever seen, like, the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi, or these guys train for years, and they'll take a block of fish and a big cut of tuna or whatever, and then when you order, they make your food in front of you to order, and you see what it's being cut from, and it's done carefully, and it's sort of an event, you know, sushi, something you go out for like you'd go to a nice steakhouse in this country. And we somehow have in recent times gotten this notion that sushi is something that we should be having for lunch from the convenience store, or from a supermarket counter, or very often, I mean, a lot of people get their sushi from an Asian restaurant that has no cultural connection to sushi, like a Korean restaurant or a Chinese restaurant that added sushi to its menu a couple of years ago because there was the demand for it. So it went from being sort of a high-end artsy artisan food to something that's being mass-produced. And it's very similar. I compare most of the sushi we eat in this country to the drive-through hamburger. You know, you can get a very good hamburger at a nice restaurant, but most of the hamburgers that are sold in this country are not very good hamburgers. Same for sushi. And so anyway, the problem with the sushi is it becomes very easy to switch and substitute the fish, the less easy it is for the consumer to see and taste. And we eat a lot more sushi rolls now in this country than the traditional nigiri sushi, which is that piece of fish on top of rice. And if you look at, like, the next time you order, you know, a spicy tuna roll, you're getting some chopped up fish in a spicy sauce in a very, very narrow cylinder wrapped in rice and then wrapped in seaweed. And then when you actually look at it, you can see the amount of fish you can see is like the size of a pencil eraser. There's no way you can tell whether that's tuna and or whether it's escalar, which is a cheap fish that is very widely substituted for tuna in sushi restaurants. And in a study in New York, more than 90% of the time people order tuna, they did not get tuna. And the number one substitute was this fish, escalar. Escalar's nickname in the seafood industry is the Ex-Lax of the sea, because it is a fish that contains a wax that is known for giving people digestive distress. It's actually ironically banned in Japan and has been for 40 years, can't be served as food. Yet, you know, people are eating it unknowingly all the time, especially in the big cities. And there's other Asian catfish that are widely used in seafood restaurants, I mean in sushi restaurants. And in general, you've got, you know, a few things going on. You can't really see the fish. You've got a lot of strong tastes masking it, whether it's hot sauce or soy sauce, so you can't really tell what it's supposed to taste like. And when the Boston Globe did a big story on seafood fraud in New England, they went to a sushi place outside of Boston, and they tested the red snapper, and it was tilapia. And they came back and they asked the restaurant manager, how can you serve this tilapia and claim it's red snapper? And their position was basically, look, we're not trying to lie. It's just what everybody in the in the industry does. That's just normal for sushi places. You know, like they didn't even feel like they were doing anything wrong. This kind of fraud is so normal.
Wow. So, it, not only are you not getting the fish you are buying, but you may be getting a really inferior type of fish that just not as healthy and beneficial as well. So you don't know what you're getting.
Right. So the in sushi, the number one substitute for tuna is this escalar, which you probably don't want to eat. In general, for red snapper, the number one substitute is a fish called tilefish, which is so high in mercury that it's on the FDA's do not eat list for pregnant women and sensitive diners.
Wow.
And most of these pricey fish, whether it's red snapper or tuna or grouper or cod, are entirely wild-caught fish, right? There's no farmed grouper. There's no farmed red snapper. So when you buy these fish, you have this presumption, like we talked about with the salmon, that you're getting something that came from the ocean. Now, instead of that, you're often getting like a farmed fish from Southeast Asia, where a lot of the fish farms have been caught using banned antibiotics, banned chemicals, even slave labor. You know, there's sort of no end to the litany of offenses that have come out of some of these Asian fish farms, and over 90% of the seafood we eat in this country is imported with very, very little oversight. So, yeah, sometimes you're getting defrauded economically, sometimes you're getting defrauded in terms of health, sometimes it's even dangerous, and sometimes it's all of the above.
Just one quick question before we take a break. Do you know what percentage of the fish that we are consuming comes from farmed fisheries?
About 40%. And like I said, not all aquaculture is bad. There's certain fish where it doesn't work well is for carnivorous ocean fish like salmon. Where it works well is for freshwater fish like tilapia, which is why there's so much tilapia. It's easy to farm. It's pretty clean. And if you actually want to buy tilapia, you're in good shape because, you know, it's an inexpensive fish. Nobody's going to substitute. The problem is it's used to fake for other things. And also bivalves, oysters, mussels are arguably better farmed. Most of the really good restaurants in the country use farmed shellfish or farmed oysters and mussels. So catfish in the south, a lot of it is farmed and a lot of it is good. It's just, you know, so not all fish farming is bad, but it's soon it will be, you know, half of the fish we eat.
Wow. And one other quick question before we take a break, because then we'll move on to other things. What's the best shrimp to buy?
I think wild-caught shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico. It not only... you know, do I like the wild caught because it doesn't have the drugs and a lot of the problems associated with farm shrimp, but it also tastes really good because of the way shrimp kind of live in the mud and in the dirt, and the nutrients and the temperature are all very important. The way the Mississippi River flows into the Gulf and constantly replenishes the nutrient of the silt and keeps the temperature constant. It's just a really good environment for shrimp, and shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico command the highest prices internationally. The problem is they're so desirable in other countries that we export a lot of our really good shrimp and re-import cheap shrimp. So I only buy shrimp from the Gulf of Mexico. Shrimp from the Gulf of Maine is good too, but for the last 2 years they've had a moratorium on it for the stocks to rebuild. So you cannot currently buy shrimp from the Gulf of Maine.
And I recently saw this shrimp from Argentina. Is it the red? They call it the red shrimp. Is that a good thing?
Yeah. So there's a kind of the rarest or most high-end shrimp is called the royal red shrimp, and it's found in like three spots off of Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida. And it's a very deep water, cold water shrimp. It is considered the sort of like the Kobe beef of shrimp, but there's not many of them and they don't ship well. So they have a very similar shrimp in Argentina that is actually easier to get than the version from the U.S. I don't think it's quite as good as the domestic version, but it's still it's a very good shrimp.
Okay, great information. All right, well, we have more to talk about. We're going to talk about olive oil and cheese and coffee and juice and honey. We have lots to talk about when we come back. But first, let's take a station break. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and we will be right back.
This This is PRN. PRN. For the Progressive Radio Network.
Does the current dire state of the economy have you totally upset and confused? There are solutions to our financial ills, but first we have to get a handle on what's really going on. I'm Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt, and a new radio show host here on PRN-FM, inviting you to join me and my co-host, Walt McCree, as we look behind the curtain at the shadowy world of global monetary control and what we can do to break ourselves free. The show is called It's Our Money, and it airs on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking with experts in the world of monetary policy, as well as with people who are actively working to reclaim control of public money to benefit the public interest. So please join us for It's Our Money, Wednesdays on PRN, FM, or by podcast.
The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour interviews the most exciting innovators in the field of mental health, from therapists and researchers to advocates of patient rights. Join me and other pioneers in psychology, psychiatry, and empathic living with the aim of improving your life and the lives of everyone you touch. Wednesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Listen live or on the archives 24/7 at PRN.fm. Don't forget to rate the show on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know, and today we're talking with the best-selling author, Larry Olmsted, and we're exploring real food, fake food, why you don't know what you're eating, and what you can do about it. A really important show to help you get exactly what you're paying for, and just the highest quality food, and not be deceived. So Larry, you did such a great job talking about the whole fish scene, but I want to move over to olive oil now, because I'm a big fan of olive oil, and I am trying to get the best virgin organic olive oil, but you have a lot to say out of the research you've done in this olive oil world and what's really going on. So fill us in.
Sure. And I should say, because my background is as a food and travel writer, I came to this book from the perspective of taste, right? I'm interested in foods primarily that taste really good. And it turns out that, the most of the foods that taste really good are real foods, and then they also happen to be healthier. So it's a nice synergy, but I didn't set out to write a book on healthy eating. I set out to write a book on delicious eating. It just sort of worked out that they go hand in hand. And olive oil is a really good example. I love olive oil. I use way more of it than the average American. When it's good, it's really delicious. I mean, in Greece, people actually drink olive oil. They don't just use it to cook or put on their food. It can be that good. So, and I've had olive oil that, you take a sip and you want to slurp it up. So it's not sort of the taste that people are used to in this country from your supermarket olive oil. And, extra virgin olive oil is the healthiest, widely used fat. It's most people recommend, if you're going to use an oil in the house, you use extra virgin olive oil. It's been proven to be heart healthy, but there's also been numerous other studies linking it with all sorts of health benefits, from an anti-carcinogen to an anti-Alzheimer's food to an anti-aging agent. And it seems to me like every time there's a study done, they find something better about it. You want to get the maximize those nutritional benefits, you want to get the freshest, best quality olive oil you can, which also is going to maximize the flavor in a way that is so revolutionary that I think most Americans have never tasted good olive oil. And I've had a number of chefs and experts tell me that. I did a book signing a couple of weeks ago where we did an olive oil tasting from a gourmet store at the signing, and every single person in the audience was like, wow, I've never tasted anything like this. So, and the good thing about it is once you taste really good olive oil, it's so different that you won't be fooled again. You can't go back to kind of crappy olive oil. And so the issue is, with olive oil, you know, it comes in various grades, and I like to compare it to gasoline. When you go to fill your car, you have regular, premium, and super premium or ultra premium gas, usually three choices. And in the world of olive oil, when they make olive oil, it's graded, and the top tier is extra virgin, and then there's virgin, and then there's just olive oil. So you really only want to be eating extra virgin olive oil, but the problem is a lot of what is labeled extra virgin olive oil in this country does not actually meet the standard for extra virgin olive oil. And so, you know, in the international labeling standard, extra virgin olive oil, and virgin and extra virgin olive oil by definition means it can only be obtained through the mechanical processing of olives, and that means either crushing or spinning in a centrifuge. You can't add anything, you can't heat it, you can't use chemicals, it's just what comes out of an olive. While most of our other oils, canola oil, sunflower oil, peanut oil, are seed oils, olive oil is a fruit oil, and it's equivalent to fresh squeezed fruit juice. You crush an olive, you get olive oil instead of orange juice, which is why it doesn't last for very long. So once you do that, it's graded, and it's graded by both laboratory analysis. There are chemical standards, the free fatty acids, and different benchmarks it has to score above to be extra virgin. And then it also has a sensory test where a panel of experts actually smell it and taste it before labeling it extra virgin. And there's very, very few foods in the world that are subject to sort of actual flavor testing to meet their standard, which is one of the things that makes extra virgin olive oil so special. But when I went to Spain, which is the world's largest producer of olive oil, one of the experts I talked to there told me that maybe 8 or 10% of all the olive oil produced should make the standard for extra virgin, because it's supposed to be the A-plus of olive oil. But almost all the olive oil in the supermarket here is labeled extra virgin. And a number of tests conducted by the University of California, Davis, or Consumer Reports, 60 Minutes, using different methodologies, have consistently found that more than half of the retail olive oil in this country does not meet the standard to be labeled extra virgin. So you really want to be careful about what you buy, but once you figure it out, it's really easy to always enjoy good, delicious, wholesome olive oil.
So do you look for organic, virgin, extra virgin olive oil? Would that be a sure bet?
No. As a matter of fact, it's one of the. I'm a big fan of the organic standard in general, but I don't think it lends as much weight when it comes to olive oil. And one of the experts I talked to, said that he's seen plenty of olive oil labeled organic that was neither organic nor extra virgin olive oil. I think the things to look for more are the place of origin and the freshness. And like I said, it's a fresh squeezed fruit juice. It doesn't last a long time. And the better the quality of the olive oil when it's made, the longer it'll last. So most of the experts I talked to in the industry told me that if you take the best possible quality of oil and bottle it, it's got a shelf life of about a year from when it's made. You know, maybe 11 months, maybe 13 months, but around a year. And so some good olive oils will have on the bottle, on the label, a pressed on or harvested on date. And that's really what you want to look for, because they're essentially the same, because olives are always crushed within about a day of picking. So harvested or pressed on date is what you want to look for. And you want that ideally to be maybe, you know, within the last 6 months. But what a lot of the oils do is they'll put a bottled on date, and that suddenly becomes meaningless because, especially in Europe, they'll hold the oil in tanks for a year or more before they ever put it in a bottle. So it's already stale when it's being bottled, but by saying, you know, bottled on makes it sound like that was when it was made, which it is not. And then a lot of other oils will put a use-by or sell-by date, you know, like we would see on other foods that go bad. But there's no standard, and they're usually way too long. I was in New York a couple of weeks ago, and I went into a gourmet store, and I saw all these bottles of like $35, $40 olive oil that had sell-by dates of December 2017, when there's no way that oil is still going to be good a year and a half from now. So, again, you want to look for the pressed on or the harvested on date. And then there's a couple of other things on the label. And again, in the book, I go into great detail on what to look for. But California makes some excellent olive oil, and they have a higher standard called California Olive Oil Council 100% certified extra virgin that, look for that seal on the label if it's from California. If you want to buy Italian olive oil, there's a higher standard seal called 100% Qualità Italiana. And I personally, I like to buy Southern Hemisphere oils. Australia has the strictest legal standards in the world for olive oil labeling, higher than all of Europe and the United States. So if you see olive oil from Australia, I recommend you buy that. Chile also makes excellent olive oil.
And the other problem is that olive oil is often, the cheaper ones, are often cut with seed oils. And they go rancid and can be a really big problem.
Yeah, so historically, I mean, olive oil adulteration goes back a long, long time, and there have been numerous instances of finding, bottles labeled extra virgin that were diluted with canola oil or peanut oil or soy oil. That's not as common as it used to be. Certainly not going to say it doesn't happen, but it's become less common both because testing has become better, chemical testing, and also the price of olive oil has gone down over recent years compared to the other oils, so there's a little less incentive to cut it. But what people have to be wary of is there's a lot of these blends on the market that are not labeled extra virgin olive oil. They're labeled like Mediterranean olive oil or flavored olive oil, or the worst one is light olive oil because, yeah, you know, people buy that thinking it's lighter in calories. It's not. In the industry, that's known as light in flavor. And once you take away the word the words extra virgin are no legal guarantee because we've seen again and again that it's misused. But once you take away the words extra virgin, it no longer has to contain only olive oil. It can be a blend. So I would recommend never buying any olive oil product that does not have extra virgin on the label.
Well, you would have really loved the olive oil I had when I was in Israel recently because one of the participants in my workshop has her family has an olive grove, and she gave me the olive oil that they freshly pressed from their groves by hand. And I went home with this wonderful bottle of precious olive oil, which was
fantastic. And it tastes a lot different, right?
Yeah, it was beautiful. I wish I had a big, vat of it, but it was a wonderful experience. I really appreciated it. Okay, so let's talk about, I think we should talk about honey and maple syrup because those are so commonly used and bought, but they're not always what people think they are. Let's talk a bit about that in the time we have left.
Sure, and I live in Vermont, which, is probably the world's most famous maple syrup producing place, so I know a little bit about this. Now, with the maple syrup, it's not the type of outright criminal fraud you see in some of these other foods. It's usually more really slick marketing where they'll take a breakfast syrup, like these things like Aunt Jemima and Log Cabin, they don't say maple syrup on them because they're not pure maple syrup. But they'll take those kind of cheaper products made out of high fructose corn syrup and things and put them in one of those plastic jugs that we think of when we think of maple syrup and sort of package it and market it in a way where if you don't read the small print, you think you're buying maple syrup. But you can get around that just by looking. If it's labeled 100% pure maple syrup, it usually is. The bigger problem is maple syrup is very rarely used in maple-flavored foods. I went to a maple syrup sort of industry event where one of the people went to the supermarket and bought every box of maple and brown sugar-flavored oatmeal cereal energy bar that they had, and only one of them, when we looked at the ingredients, we're looking at dozens of products, actually had maple syrup on the ingredients. They might have a picture of a jug of maple syrup and maple in the name, but there's no maple in it. So that's what consumers really have to worry about with maple syrup is when it's ostensibly used as a flavoring in other foods. Honey, on the other hand, there is a lot of outright criminal fraud, and honey is basically sugar, but it's the most expensive form of sugar. So if you can cut it with any other kind of sugar, and most common are high fructose corn syrup and beet sugar, you've lowered the price of what you're selling and you're making more money, and almost no one can tell because it's still sweet and it's still golden liquid colored. So the largest financial food fraud crime ever prosecuted in the history of the United States was a sophisticated honey smuggling ring brought in $60 million worth of adulterated honey from China and pawned it off as being from other places because Chinese honey was banned in this country. So it's not a small potatoes kind of mom and pop crime because a lot of times supermarkets are buying that unknowingly, and also a lot of the honey we use in this country goes into other foods, again, cereal, any kind of granola bar. If you want to actually buy honey itself, like to put in your tea or cook with at home, the good news is it's pretty easy. Almost all of the adulteration and crime associated with honey is with imported honey, and honey is one of the only foods that is made everywhere, even in a big city. You know, you can get honey that's made in Brooklyn or Chicago or, you know, pretty much anywhere you live in the country, you can buy local honey. And if you do, at the farmer's market or a specialty store, you immediately circumvent most of the problems with honey.
I mean, you know, in your book, you're talking about honey being adulterated with high fructose corn syrup. I mean, that's terrible to think that you're getting this really toxic sugar in what you think is a healthy food.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's the reason people generally use honey is as a preferred form of sugar over other kinds of sugar. And, you know, they have this honey out of New Zealand called Manuka honey. And it's sort of the Kobe beef of honey, because the Manuka bushes that the bees feed on only grow in New Zealand. And a lot of kind of holistic or homeopathic fans think that this honey has all these special health attributes. It's highly prized. It's more popular in the UK than it is in the US, but it's really desirable in the UK. And they did a study there. They bought the 8 leading supermarket brands of Manuka honey, and only one of them turned out to actually be Manuka honey. So you're talking, you're charging top dollar for a specialty item, and 7/8 of it is crap. And it's really amazing the level of fraud that goes on.
Well, that's shocking, because I actually do get Manuka honey when I go to New Zealand. Are you saying it's fraudulent in New Zealand, or is just labeled Manuka honey when it gets here and, you know, people think they're getting
the real deal? Yeah, well, this particular study was in the UK. So I'm assuming it's easier to get in New Zealand than any place else.
Yeah, but because it's popular, people are fraudulent in what they're putting in their honey jars and
labeling.
I mean,
the rule of thumb across all food is if you have something that's more expensive and more desirable, and you can substitute something that looks like it that's cheap, there's going to be fraud. I mean, that's what I interviewed the former chairman of the FDA, and he told me it's simple economics. Doesn't really matter what the food is. If it's got a high value and you can sell something that people will believe is it, that's cheaper, there people are going to do that, whether it's honey or fish or Kobe beef.
Right. So is there anyone looking after our health, or is there, you know, the USDA, FDA, anyone that you found that is actually checking things so we are protected in some way?
Yeah, well, the problem is that the responsibility is pretty segmented. So, you know, the USDA is responsible for sort of physical inspections, and they do a good job, but they're not really a consumer-facing enforcement agency. The FDA at the federal level is the most responsible, and I think they do a pretty bad job. The seafood issue got so bad that in 2014, President Obama convened a special task force to combat illegal fishing and seafood fraud, and their recommendations are just starting to go into place this year, and a lot of it was aimed at revamping the way the FDA was doing its job. So I think that there's definitely some hope on that horizon. I think the seafood policing is starting to improve. It'll be a slow process, but there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I think the real hope in the short term is at the state level. All the restaurant stuff is up to the states. When a restaurant defrauds its customers, that's ultimately up to the states to criminalize or prosecute. And it's a lot easier to pass laws these days at the state level than in Congress. And some states already do a better job. There's been a lot of seafood fraud in restaurants in Florida, and Florida has actually prosecuted restaurants, which rarely happens elsewhere. And also in terms of standards, Connecticut and California enacted stricter labeling standards for olive oil than the rest of the country. And I think you're going to continue, there's a thing in Vermont now with the GMO labeling. I think you're going to continue to see sort of the individual states picking up this fight because they're realizing that, you know, in a lot of cases, the federal government is not going to help their consumers out.
Yeah, so that's why your book is so important, Real Food, Fake Food, which is the website, realfoodfakefood.com. And I do encourage everyone listening to pick up a copy of the book because it really is so enlightening and it helps us to make the best choice possible regarding our foods. And you've done a really good job, Larry. I just commend you for the amount of time. I mean, 4 years putting a book together is a long time to do research, you know. But you've made us so aware of what's really going on. And, of course, there's a lot more that you talk about. We just have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else you just want to wrap this interview up with?
Sure. I just like to say, you know, When I do these kind of interviews, you know, we talk a lot about this gloom and doom and, you know, what you're getting or what you're not getting. But, you know, I called the book Real Food, Fake Food. I started with real food because I think that's important. You know, in the book, I take the reader to a lot of places where delicious foods are made. I show them how, you know, real cheese, real olive oil, a lot of real things are produced and why they're so good, and talk to a lot of chefs, and there's even recipes. So it's not all like, you know, oh, horror, don't buy this. You know, there's a lot of what we call food porn in the book. You know, like I've had a lot of people tell me, oh, you made me so hungry, I want to go to Italy or I want to go to Japan. And, you know, it's a half glass empty, half full thing, but there's a lot of lot of tasty and optimistic food stuff in there as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're educating us, and with anything, we need to know what our best choice is and why so we can make that best choice. So I appreciate the work you've done to enlighten us all and to be able to navigate through this world so we can get the real food that we deserve. And that really is the most nourishing for us. So, you know, thank you so much for all the effort you've put into creating this book. And thank you for your time today, Larry. It's just been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. You're a great host.
Oh, you're welcome. So we've been talking to Larry Olmsted, author of Real Food, Fake Food. Be sure you pick up a copy of the book, go to his website, get the real food you deserve. And this is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.